So this week we're going to kick off a new series looking at the book of Ecclesiastes called Searching for Meaning. And throughout this series, we're going to look a little bit at the life of Solomon, the person of Solomon, and also at the statements he makes about life in this interesting book in the Bible. And there are a lot of opinions on the book of Ecclesiastes. In 1862, during a dark time in our nation's experience, Abraham Lincoln stood before Congress and he quoted Ecclesiastes chapter 1 verse 4 in the midst of the Civil War, and in the Old English. He said, "One generation passeth away and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever." There was also the famous American novelist, a man named Tom Wolfe, who once said, "Ecclesiastes is the greatest single piece of writing I have ever known, and the wisdom expressed in it the most lasting and profound." And then in Moby Dick, Herman Melville wrote, "The truest of all men was the man of sorrows, and the truest of all books is Solomon's, and Ecclesiastes is the fine hammered steel of woe," which I also thought about as a title for this series, "The Fine Hammered Steel of Woe." He said, "All is vanity, all." Ecclesiastes is not necessarily a bright, cheery book that we're about to approach. And even while someone who's experiencing a level of incredible hardship might look to Ecclesiastes like Abraham Lincoln did, or someone who has an appreciation for literary style or for sorrow might look to Ecclesiastes as a book that they would like to focus in on, a lot of people kind of choose to ignore the message of the book of Ecclesiastes. There are some throughout time who have even said, you know, kind of, what is this writing, what is this book doing inside of the Bible? Because what Ecclesiastes gives us is the picture of a life without meaning. And so we're going to look into this book for the next several weeks. And to give a little background information, the author of this book doesn't ever identify himself by name, but he does use the Hebrew word Koheleth. And so that is kind of how he identifies himself. And that word would be translated into either preacher or teacher. In the Greek, that word is translated as ekklesiastou, which is the same word that we get ekklesia, or the church, from. And so again, it's this idea of being a teacher or a preacher. And so in English, we've called the book Ecclesiastes, and that would be literally translated as the teacher or the preacher. And the person that wrote this is King Solomon. We see this from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1, where even though he doesn't identify himself by name, he identifies himself as saying, "The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem." Many translations, we even make that a little more clear and say that it's not just son of David, which could kind of be someone sitting under the family of David or someone that's a relative to him, but to say the son of David, referring specifically to King Solomon. And a few things we know about King Solomon in his life. We know that he was the son and the successor of King David. So David is the second king of Israel, and his son Solomon follows in his footsteps and ascends to the throne and becomes the third and really the final king of a united Israel. So at the end of Solomon's life, what we find out is that because of some of the things that he has done, the kingdom of Israel, the 12 tribes, are going to be split up into two kingdoms. The northern kingdom, which will keep the name Israel, and the southern kingdom, which will become the kingdom of Judah. And so Solomon, only their third king in their history, is the final king over this united Israel kingdom. And finally, and this is what most of us probably think of when we think of Solomon, is that he's well known for being regarded as the wisest man outside of Jesus, the perfect God-man, to ever walk this earth. And we see why he was regarded in this way when we look at his life as it's described in the book of 1 Kings. And so in 1 Kings chapter 3, we're not going to read all of that book this morning. We're not going to read all of the section on Solomon's life this morning. But when we look at chapter 3, we see that Solomon is ascending to become the king of Israel. And when he does, he has this prayer that he makes to God. And basically he says, I'm in great humility, especially humility for someone who's just become king over an empire that's on the rise and someone who might not exercise much humility. He makes this prayer to God where he says, look, I can't do this. I'm a child. I'm not wise enough to be able to rule rightly over these people, your people that have been entrusted to me. So please give me the ability to understand the difference between right and wrong. And this is the way that God responds to him in 1 Kings chapter 3, beginning in verse 10. It said, the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, since you have asked for this and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. And he goes on to say, not only is he going to bless him and give him this sense of wisdom and this ability to administer justice as a king, but he's also, because Solomon asked for this, instead of asking for the wealth, instead of asking for an expanded kingdom, instead of asking for death for his enemies, that he's going to give him that those material possessions as well. He's going to give him that kind of objective factors of a successful ruling. He's going to give Solomon great wealth. He's going to bless the kingdom under Solomon's reign. And so just like that, Solomon is endowed with wisdom from God that he immediately puts into practice. If we read through, we see that it's the next stories about Solomon are how he takes over and then he has this great kind of insight and wisdom to be able to lead God's people well. And so the kingdom grows. They experience these great building campaigns under Solomon. They experience this great sense of material wealth. And we read this about Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 29 and 30. It says, God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the people of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. It follows that in the verses to come after with saying he's specifically wise than some of these people that were considered to be kind of the wisest people of his day. It says that Solomon went on and he wrote 3,000 proverbs, many of which we see in the book of Proverbs, but certainly not all of his 3,000 proverbs. It says that he wrote 1,005 songs and not just kind of pop songs, but songs of wisdom, songs that were sharing a meaning, that were teaching lessons in his songs. And so Solomon is fittingly the author of much of the wisdom material that we read in the Old Testament, the author of much of the wisdom literature. And to give a brief overview of those books, a very brief overview of the five books that are considered wisdom literature, we have, and this is not in their order in Scripture, but the first is the Book of Psalms. And certainly while there are several different psalm writers, even Solomon has a few psalms that are attributed to him, when many of us read through or look at or think about the Book of Psalms, we think of King David, Solomon's father. And King David was a man who didn't have the same level of wisdom, the level head that Solomon had, but he was a man that gives us this incredible picture of what it's like to be in relationship with God. He gives us this kind of emotional view of what it's like to at times feel like God is right beside us and we're close and we're experiencing his protection, and then at other points to feel like he couldn't be any farther away from us. We see that in the narrative of David's life as we read through the Book of Psalms. Another wisdom book is the Book of Proverbs, and this collection of proverbs, and so they're kind of short, pithy statements that express some greater truth about life and some piece of wisdom for us to chew on. This was a book written directly by Solomon. It explains for us what it means to live a life that's faithful to God. It helps us to live in a way that's wise so that we don't get ensnared into all sorts of problems that we can experience in life. A third wisdom book, also written by Solomon, is the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon. And this is a book that in some ways is very interesting to even have included in the wisdom literature. This is a book that is the celebration of Solomon very personally in the intimacy of his marriage experience. And so it was one that even in the teachings of rabbis would be reserved for more mature students before they would digest on that. But it gives us this picture of marital intimacy. And then there's the book of Job. And I bring that up right before Ecclesiastes because the book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastes, they kind of communicate to us the same message and come at it from some different angles. The book of Job provides readers with this incredible narrative about a man that lives through an incredible level of hardship, about a man that lives through these incredible struggles that he has in life. And these struggles that we read about in Job are brought on by Satan. As Satan is seeking to turn Job's heart away from God, he subjects him to these incredible hardships, things that are hard for us to imagine. But in a very short amount of time, when we read through Job, we see that he loses his wealth and he loses his possessions. We see that he loses his family, his children. We see that he loses his own health. And in that moment of hardship, when we read through Job, we see that he not only has all of this kind of these bad things happening to him, but he has bad advice that he's been given. We see him with friends who are kind of, they keep coming at him and they keep giving him this bad advice, and Job refuses to listen to it. And Job refuses to turn his back on God. And then even in kind of the height of his sorrow, the height of his experience of suffering, Job's wife comes to him and says, "Job, wouldn't it be better for you to curse God and die?" And can we imagine being in that kind of a position with our spouse? So we kind of have lost everything. We're in this incredibly hard place to be in. And in that moment of suffering, the one person who we're walking through life with says, "Maybe it would be better for you to just die, to kind of end this." And it doesn't say that she says that out of malice for Job or out of an excitement for him to pass away, but that she says that to kind of say, this suffering kind of needs to end, and maybe this is the step that you need to just take to move on. But Job refuses to do that. Job refuses to turn his back on God. Job refuses, even when he doesn't understand what is happening, he refuses to buy into the belief that God can't act in his circumstance, to buy into the belief that God isn't powerful enough, to buy into the belief that maybe God isn't real because he's experienced all of this hardship. And something happens for us oftentimes when we go through a level of hardship like Job experiences. For many of us, even if we never experience that level of hardship, we start to assume that the grass must be greener on the other side. We start to assume that whenever we go through periods of struggle and hardship, no matter what it is, that the grass must be greener on the other side. We do this all the time, and maybe most often with issues related to our money, where we assume, many of us, when we're going through a period where we're struggling with finances or where there's uncertainty with finances, we assume that if we just had a little bit more money that could fix the current problem we're in, that everything would be greener on the other side of that struggle. Or we do this with relationships, where many times we begin to think if the relationship we're going through is in a period of struggling, that if we could just end that relationship, if we were just in a relationship with someone else, that it would be a cure-all to the problems that we're experiencing in life. For many of us, we assume that if we're stressed out at work, if we're struggling because we're working too much, that the answer would be that someday, whenever we can just work a little bit less, the grass will be greener on the other side of that. And some people have the exact opposite experience. When we struggle to find work, when we struggle to know what's next, we think, if I just had a job, if I just had something more, that the grass would be greener on that side of the equation. All the time in life, we play this kind of scenario out where we think that if our circumstances could be just a little bit different, then everything would be fixed in our life. Or we think that if we just had one thing that was different, then maybe we would be able to, live a happy and easy life. That life would be cured. And then we come to the book of Ecclesiastes, which just kind of shatters that entire conception that the grass is always greener on the other side. As we looked at the beginning of Solomon's reign over Israel, it was clear that things started off in the right direction. But we know that eventually all of this kind of success of the kingdom had this negative impact on Solomon as a king, and had this negative impact on Solomon as a person. Throughout his reign as king, we know that Solomon married hundreds of women, that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and that the reason for many of these marriages was no doubt for political advantage. That when he was trying to build up alliances, when he was trying to build his own status as a king, he was taking all of these different wives. But it wasn't just, and that's not to excuse that action, but it wasn't just that there was no relationship between them. We know when we look at Solomon's life that eventually, as he was marrying these women from all kinds of different regions of the earth, from all kinds of different kingdoms, that eventually he began to practice some of their worship as well. That he began to worship other gods that were not the God of Israel. And eventually, when we read about his life in 1 Kings in chapters 10 and 11, we see this story of Solomon turning his back on God. That at some point in time, this worship of other gods, this whether it was his great success that he experienced in this life, he no longer felt a need to worship the God. And so, this is the setting for the writing of the book of Ecclesiastes. It comes near the end of Solomon's life. It comes after he has turned his heart away from God. And so it was written somewhere around 900 BC, near the end of Solomon's reign, that we have this book of wisdom. And we're going to begin by reading in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. And we're going to read the first 11 verses through today, but we're just going to look at verses 1 and 2 right now. It says, "The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless." And so it's significant that at the beginning of this book, Solomon identifies himself as teacher. Because what that says to us is that this isn't just Solomon writing about the experience of his life, that this is his lesson that he is teaching to people. And what he begins that lesson by saying, and kind of the theme of this book, is this idea of meaningless, meaningless. Or if you read a different translation of scripture, it might say vanity, vanity, or vanity of vanities. This idea that life, as we know, and life as many of us experience it, is meaningless. And as we think about Solomon writing that, we need to remember who he is. Because we could be tempted to think, you know, if we read through the book of Job and we see this guy who's had his wealth taken away from him, his children taken away from him, his health taken away from him, we could see if Job, when he's kind of sitting on the ash heap of his life and dogs are licking his wounds, him saying, "This has all been meaningless." But that's not the position that Solomon is in when we read about his life. Solomon is a king. Solomon is someone who is living high off the hog in life. He's someone who has servants who are catering to him 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He's someone who has vast wealth. When we read about what's going on in the book of 1 Kings, this is at, you know, there's a lot of reading where we look at the people of Israel in a position of struggling and hardship, but that is not what it was like in the days of Solomon. The people who are around him, they're paying tribute to the king, the kingdoms that are around him. He's amassing this incredible sense of wealth. Wealth like none of us can hope to attain in this life. He's powerful. He's in charge. He's this man who has people being sent from kingdoms all over the world to listen in on the wisdom of Solomon. And it says that it wasn't just wisdom about reigning as king. It wasn't just wisdom about administering justice, but that his wisdom was kind of boundless. When we read about what he spoke to people about, he's talking to them about plants. He's talking to them about fish and reptiles and birds. He's talking to them about all kinds of different matters in life. This is a guy who is smart, a guy who is wise, a guy who is rich and powerful, a guy who, with every objective measure of success, he meets them. And yet, at the end of the day, at the end of his life, he comes back and he questions whether anything has meaning. He exclaims, in fact, that it doesn't when he says meaningless, meaningless. And so it's right for us to ask the question, when he says everything, does he really mean everything? Because when he wrote Song of Solomon earlier, it certainly seemed as though he was saying there's a great deal of meaning in that marriage relationship. When he wrote the book of Proverbs earlier, it certainly seemed like he was saying there was a great deal of meaning in living a life that is wise and faithful to the Lord. When we look at that prayer at the beginning of his reign as king, it certainly seems like there was some meaning that he was attaching to being the leader over the people that God had entrusted to him, and he recognized the weight and the gravity of that. It wasn't like he was a 12-year-old that became king and just was concerned with living a life of pleasure and living in that kind of way. There was meaning that he spoke about earlier in his life, and yet later in the end, in Ecclesiastes, it seems like that meaning has evaporated. And he goes on to talk about this lack of meaning, beginning in verse 3, when he says, "What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, where they return again." Solomon asserts that the reason life is meaningless is because we spend all of this time in toil under the sun from the day we're born until the day we die, and that really, at the end of our lives, we have nothing to show for it. This is the realization that happens to lots of people when they get their driver's license, right? You have this moment that you waited for and you anticipated. And you said, "I can't wait to experience this incredible level of new freedom where I'm not going to be bound by getting a ride to go wherever I need to go. I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to do what I want, when I want, and go where I want." And then we realize that gas is almost $3 a gallon. And we realize that car insurance costs money. And we realize that cars are an expense that we need to account for. And so all of the sudden we think, well, for me to be able to have this car, I need to have a job to support having this car. For me to be able to experience the incredible freedom of going out with my friends and doing what I want, when I want, how I want, I need to have money to have that experience. And so we get a job, and then we spend all of that incredible freedom driving to and from our jobs. That's the same experience that many people have when they think having a big home, having a really nice house is something that's going to bring their life this great sense of meaning and experience. So we spend all of this money to build this incredible dream house that we always wanted and that we saved and scrapped for, and then we work 70 hours a week and we never enjoy that home. We do this in all kinds of areas of life where we think if we just work a little harder, if we just toil in this kind of way, if we just keep looking for the grass to be greener at this next plateau or experience in life, and then it just kind of seems to let us down. And so Solomon, in a time before modern cars and before modern homes, he looks at the things that we chase in this life, and he says that in the end, it amounts to nothing. And when he says that generations come and generations go, he's saying that we're born and we die and we don't leave much of a mark on our time here. It's kind of this picture of a hamster on a wheel. The hamster gets on the wheel and it runs and runs and runs and runs, but it's still stuck in its cage, not going anywhere. And I know this was not the inspiration many of you were looking for when you came to church today, but we're going to read on to verse 11. He says this, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. In these passages, Solomon says, even when we think something is new, something is going to change our lives, something is going to make everything better, we've already thought that in the past. And we might be tempted to think, well, Solomon wrote this before the incredible level of technological and scientific innovation that we experience today. And while things might change maybe more quickly or change in a different way today, Solomon's still writing this. Part of the human experience has been innovation and changing practice. So it wasn't like they didn't have new things in Solomon's time, just like they do in our time today. But he's saying that even in the midst of those new things, they're never going to fix the problems that we want them to. They're never going to correct the issues of the past. They're never going to make our future be without any level of pain or hardship. It's the new things are never going to live up to the hype that we're hoping they will. And we see this all the time in brief periods of even innovation. If we think about cell phones started as big blocks, as big bricks. And then through years of innovation, they kept tweaking them and making them smaller and smaller and smaller. And then they put a screen on one and connected it to the internet, and they thought that screen's too small. So now they're getting big again. So they went from big to small, now back to big. Well, we see it with the way we wear wristwatches. For generations, people wore a watch to be able to know what time it was. And then for a whole generation of people, cell phones killed wristwatches. They were obsolete, or they were accessories. They were things that people didn't need. And then someone thought, well, if we put that screen in the internet on the watch, we can bring back wristwatches. So they were out, and now they're back. We see that in the way we take notes. People used to walk into meetings with a pad of paper and a pen and write down notes. And then that kind of became obsolete when the iPad and when all these electronic notebooks came out that you could type on, and you could just have all your notes right there on an electric tablet that you could again connect to the internet. But then that typing wasn't quite as smooth, so they developed touch screens and styluses, and now they walk in and you write with your handwriting that you still can't read on the tablet, and you save the notes. We have this process where innovation keeps repeating itself. And it's not just in the area of technology. There have been hundreds and hundreds of years of medical and scientific and agricultural innovation. And the hottest diet trends tell us that we should eat like cavemen. That after all of the processed food phases that we've gone through, that after all of that innovation, that not having chemicals or pesticides is healthier for us. We see that in fashion. You know, a decade ago, people weren't wearing bow ties, and now they're back. Jeans get tighter and looser on tops and bottoms, but we cycle through these kinds of things. In cultural trends, if in the 80s, if you went to a hair band and you told them that in 30 years the banjo was going to come back and be cool, they would think you were crazy. But we do this in life. where we cycle through these new kinds of trends, this new place where we look for meaning. And Solomon knows that when these things come and go, when innovation promises us the easy life, that it just isn't going to live up to the hype. We just don't find our sense of meaning in those things. And as we continue to look at the book of Ecclesiastes over the next few weeks, we're going to look at the life of Solomon and how he describes his pursuit for meaning in things like wisdom and religion and wealth and power and work. And how at the end, he arrives at the conclusion that when he looks to the things of this life for meaning, he doesn't find it. And this is depressing. And so we should ask the question, like many people have asked, is Solomon writing something that's descriptive or prescriptive? We see both of those things in the Bible, where we see sometimes something is descriptive. It's telling us, this is what happened, this is what my experience was, this is the thing that I encountered in life, or this is what I did. And some of those things we shouldn't even think about doing. And other times the Bible is prescriptive. It tells us how we should live, what we should think about life, how we should view the world, how we should understand God. And so we're kind of left with two questions thinking about the book of Ecclesiastes. Is Solomon describing his actual view of life and his experiences? And is this really the way the Bible and Solomon teaches us that we should all be viewing life? And the answer to the first question is easy. It's clear when we read this book that Solomon is saying this is his experience and his view of life. When he writes Ecclesiastes and he says meaningless, meaningless, he means it. The second question is a little bit more difficult to answer, because the answer is yes, but. It's that in some ways, Solomon nails his description of life, but that has to come with a bit of further explanation. We need to remember as we look through this book that Solomon is writing this text as someone that is not following God, as someone that does not have faith, as someone that has actively turned his back on God. And even while Solomon began his reign as king as someone that demonstrated this great sense of humility and dependence upon God, he no longer has that while he is writing this text. He's experienced success. He's experienced work. He's accomplished incredible milestones in his reign as king, but he has walked away from a life that is faithful to God. And so, Solomon's story teaches us about a life without faith. Solomon's story teaches us the result of the pursuits that many of us are tempted to follow in this life as we search for meaning in our lives. Many of us are tempted to construct what the previously pastor and now author Timothy Keller would say. We develop these counterfeit gods in our life. Gods of money and power and wealth and pleasure. Gods that in our hearts we build these altars to, where we do everything we can to serve those pursuits, and we look to find meaning in those kinds of pursuits. Solomon's life for us is a cautionary tale, because we see what happens when we live out those pursuits. We see the result of a life that is spent serving counterfeit gods. And so for us, even while Ecclesiastes can and does, and at times will feel like a depressing book for us to look through, this is a book that gives us hope and joy as Christians, because we don't live in the same way that Solomon lived, where we look to the things of this life to provide us with meaning. We look to Christ. In John 10:10, as Jesus is talking, he says, "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Jesus doesn't say, "Look around, everything is meaningless. Be depressed. You know, he doesn't say, stop mowing your lawn and stop taking care of your kids. Stop going to work. Stop worrying about money because it's all meaningless anyway. So just sit on your couch and wait for death to find you because you're like a hamster stuck on a wheel. He doesn't give us that word when he talks about our lives. He says that he comes that we can experience life and experience life in fullness. When we place our meaning in the things of this world, we come to the same conclusions as Solomon, but Jesus, through his love and sacrifice, provided new life, a life of meaning and purpose to us. And it's a life that we look forward and anticipate experiencing in eternity, but it's also a life that we begin to live out and experience here and now in the present. A life lived through Jesus is one of incredible meaning and purpose. And as we close today, I want to ask you to consider a few things at the beginning of this look at Ecclesiastes. What are the things outside of a relationship with God that you are tempted to attach your meaning to in this life? And how do those compare to the fullness of life that we receive in Christ? How do those compare to what Jesus promises us?